I questioned my brother about it, in front of my husband, because my husband knows, along with my daughter. My brother pretended that it was nothing and didn't want to talk about it. Jennifer said that her mother never did believe what they saw, even though she always remembered how the pair were crying and shaking as they told her about it. Years later, at a family gathering at a park, Jennifer's brother waited until her husband was out of earshot before he would talk to her about the incident. "My husband later left the park to go watch soccer players," said Jennifer. "My brother walked over to me in front of my mom and daughter and said, 'Jenny, what you and I saw that day was real. It was crazy. That guy was a creature or madman of some sort.' But he said we can't tell anyone about our experience because they will think we are nuts. I said, 'Well, as long as I know the truth, that's what matters most.' I told my own family so that they know things like this do exist and to be careful." Jennifer remembers exactly where the incident took place and what the apartment complex looked like. "I omitted the street address and business names to protect the privacy of current residents, but here's her description of the neighborhood. Each apartment is treated as an individual home with their own parcel numbers and such. It happened toward the back of the driveway area at the last carport. The laundromat that is next to this property is on the corner of a small shopping center with stores. The stores that I remember being there in the 80s at the time of this encounter were a liquor store, a bicycle shop somewhere toward the middle that I'm not sure if it's still there or not, the laundromat, and a really good Mexican restaurant." She also remembered that there had been a mortuary in that vicinity, and that the neighborhood was about 2 miles or so from a beach. It's a long drive to that property from her present home in Los Angeles, but she made the trip with her husband and daughter in 2013 to show them where it happened. "They found the laundromat without problem," she said, "but she could not bring herself to get out of the car. Her husband took a few minutes to walk around the area by himself, but saw nothing out of the ordinary. Jennifer did notice that the whole place had been renovated, including the driveway, and that the old rectangular metal cover, she remembered, was gone. The carports now had doors, so that they now appear to be garages. It was like it never existed," she said, "or like someone knew it did and covered it up." Jennifer added, "I have to tell you, this place was something that I wanted to erase from my mind. I never wanted to go back to it or remember the fear that I felt. The last few years have been rather difficult for me because I want answers as to what I had seen. I could never really understand, and still don't, know why my brother can live with not trying to understand such a horrific experience. I always wanted to find out what this creature was. I wanted so much for my mom to call the police and have them go in an instant to the location to investigate, but I couldn't force her to do it." That incident was the only time in her life she ever saw something like this, or any other weird creature, said Jennifer. "I never asked for this," she said. "I wish all the time that I could turn back time to erase this sighting, because now that I have my daughter, it makes me worried. What else, or could there be more of these creatures underground, right below suburban neighborhoods?" Jennifer's recollection of the stairway and lantern made me wonder what kind of tunnel or underground space might normally open into an apartment complex parking lot next to a busy strip mall. I asked my husband, who happens to be a civil engineer specializing in wastewater management and treatment, what he thought about her description of the stairs and about the rectangular metal door. He confirmed that rectangular doors, or hatches, are indeed used in certain applications, and that they have hinges, unlike round manhole covers, to prevent the lids from falling in. He also thought that given the rectangular hatch and the location, Perhaps the stairs may have led to either a storm drainage or a utility access tunnel. And everything Jennifer described checked out, to the smallest detail. I was able to locate and view the exact site of her encounter by using online satellite maps, which showed the parking lot and former carports arranged just as she said they were. The laundromat, by the way, is now permanently closed. In addition, my friend and colleague, Sanjay R. Singhal, happened to be in Los Angeles on family business at about the time I finished interviewing Jennifer, and he took a drive to the neighborhood of that Torrance laundromat. He found the strip mall, the apartment buildings, the mortuary, and everything laid out as Jennifer had described. He also confirmed that the parking lot had been redone and that the carports had been remodeled, all exactly as she'd reported after her visit back to the scene as an adult, and took photos. He didn't see any metamorphosing lichens, nor did he observe any hatches to underground facilities, but neither did Jennifer when she went back. The details of location and environment seemed true and logical then. But what of the werewolf-like creature encountered by Jennifer and her brother? As I said earlier, I've always tended not to believe stories that describe dramatic transformations or other very sensational aspects. Most encounters with upright canids, according to eyewitnesses I hear from, are quick and rather simple events. Motorist sees creature. Motorist realizes creature is not your normal forest animal. Creature dives for cover, and motorist speeds away. It's also true, though, that over the years I've received a handful of accounts from other self-described werewolves who claim they can do exactly what Jennifer said this tunnel popper did, albeit usually not in broad daylight behind a laundromat, but I've yet to receive the video I always request from these writers that would show the world their alleged transition between species. Jennifer did seem entirely truthful, in my opinion, and she signed a release form that stated her encounter was true and factual. She said in her initial email that she would take a polygraph test. The details she included regarding the man's transformation seemed coherent and unique, right down to the blousy, pirate-like shirt style he wore, and the fact that his gums bled due to the sudden enlargement of his teeth. And yet, this type of physical morphing from a man to a manimal shouldn't be possible in the world we know. Emphasis on shouldn't and no. It does seem to happen sometimes, though, as we'll soon find in some other examples. I imagine that skeptics will also point to Jennifer's young age at the time of the incident, and the fact that several decades have passed since then to cast doubt on the accuracy of her account. Time can erode memories, yes, and many children do possess remarkable imaginations, but many people also possess remarkable ability to recollect events of the past, especially events associated with strong emotion or unusual happenings. In fact, I'm sure most people could dredge up a well-remembered incident or two from a tender age. I'm no memory savant, but I'll offer a story from my own life, just as an example of how it is possible to remember actions, emotions, and even details of the surroundings from very early childhood of an impactful event. I clearly remember a traumatic, to me, incident that occurred when I was age 3. My family was living in an upper flat, an apartment whose room arrangement I still recall, in Windsor, Wisconsin. And very vividly, I remember sneaking into the little kitchen, papered with green leaves on a white background, and pushing a wooden chair to the kitchen cupboard. I then climbed up to stand on the counter, reaching for a pink ceramic mug with a deer-shaped handle my mother had put there for fear I'd break it. I didn't, but I accidentally knocked my sister's mug, identical except that hers was blue, to the floor. I can still see it smashing into ceramic smithereens on the linoleum tile. My mother then gave the pink mug to my sister, which seemed totally unjust at the time. 30 or so years later, I happened to mention that incident to my mother. She corroborated everything, even the ivy wallpaper and the layout of the kitchen and the floor tile. If I can remember such an ordinary sort of childish trauma from quite some time ago, I don't see why the now 30-something Jennifer might not also clearly recall seeing a man change into a wolf when she was a 7-year-old, especially when her incident was far more shocking and impressive than mine. My mom did, at long last, return my pink mug to me. There's another possibility, too. What if Jennifer's memories are indeed clear and true, but the event she recalls was actually some type of illusion, either a physical one in which the man quickly pulled a realistic rubber mask over his head, although that doesn't explain the other bodily changes, or perhaps some type of paraphysical projection? By paraphysical, I mean a manifestation of a wolf-like form that is unexplainable by present science. One example of that would be the phenomenon Tibetans call a tulpa. It refers to a materialized thought form that adepts or shamans in many cultures are taught to produce by projecting their thoughts from some source inside their own mind until the thought becomes visible. The thought form may be seen by other people and may even gain enough solidity to appear real and perform tasks with physical objects. In some belief systems, this thought form does not leave the body, but surrounds its creator like a sort of spirit suit that transforms the creator's outward appearance. Both types of thought forms may be perceived by witnesses as completely real, physical, and able to interact with their surroundings, often in powerful ways. Whether such thought forms can actually occur or not, I do not claim to know, but projecting the illusion of an animal's head would be well within the bounds of what such practitioners claim is possible. Either way, Jennifer's experience leads us to beg the question we must ask, given the premise of this book, as to whether the appearance of the morphing man had anything to do with the subterranean space from which it had partly emerged. The implication that urban utility tunnels may double as portals to other worlds, or even as hidden lairs where lycanthropic makeovers take place, may seem hard to swallow. In addition, there were no weird lights, sounds, mists, vibrations, or other indications, other than the presence of the creature itself, that the tunnel was anything but a mundane utilitarian hole in the ground with a ladder from which a really weird dude could survey the topside traffic. However, there are many miles of old and mostly abandoned tunnels dug for various purposes under most of Los Angeles, as we'll find in the next encounter. Clearly, though, the creature in the tunnel was beyond unusual. On top of its stunning transformation, Jennifer felt it communicated telepathically with her, and she was surprised that it knew her name. In my view, however, the sight of a man changing into something else is weird enough, as the next two reports from the greater Los Angeles area will show. Encounter Case Summary: The Torrance Werewolf. Reported creature or creatures: human observed in the process of changing into a wolf. Location, date: laundromat parking lot in the area of Torrance, California, summer 1985. Conditions: warm summer day, excellent light, eyewitnesses very close to subject for several minutes. Associated phenomena: underground tunnel from which creature appeared to be emerging. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature: physically changed from human to wolf-like creature almost instantaneously, including fur-covered skin, paws, and fangs. Witness or witnesses: a 7-year-old girl and her older brother. Environmental factors: This was an urban environment that was likely to have been laced with underground tunnels and access areas. The VIP Werewolf of Orange. There is another, simpler way to move furtively around an urban area than slogging through sewer tunnels, and it's a means of transport that would cause no one in the Los Angeles area to bat a false eyelash. A limousine with tinted windows. On a warm day in the spring of 1982, a Chapman University student in her late 20s pulled up to an intersection in the community of El Modena in Orange, California, and sat waiting for the light to change. Her car did not have air conditioning, so her windows were rolled down. She was Tessa Dick, the fifth ex-wife of renowned novelist and science fiction writer Philip K. Dick, who had passed away earlier that year on March 2nd of a stroke. Tessa wrote me about what happened next, thanks to a connection made between us by Michael Mott, a co-host of the weekly internet radio show Unraveling the Secrets, on which Tessa had recently been a guest. As Tessa described it, "A black limousine pulled up to my car, and the rear window went down. I saw a beautiful black German Shepherd sitting there in the back seat of the limousine next to the open window. I could see the dog's head, but not his body. I was looking at the dog and smiling, and the dog was smiling back at me. He looked intelligent, and he was clean and well-groomed. I thought that the owner of the limousine had a very beautiful dog. Somehow, without knowing how or why, I simply knew that the dog was a male. But then, just before the light turned green, the dog casually put his arm on the window ledge, and he had a hand. My jaw dropped, and the dog smirked. I thought that he was chuckling, pleased with himself that he had shocked me by showing me his hand. It looked like a human hand, with fingernails, well manicured, and skin coal black like his hair. His arm had short black hair like the hair on a dog's front leg, but his hand was hairless. And the arm had an elbow and shoulder, like a human elbow and shoulder. The light turned green, and we both drove away. I never saw that limousine or the dog again. I tried to find some kind of ape or monkey with a face like that, but no such animal exists. And, of course, dogs don't have human hands. So what did I see? Now I think that the dog owned the limousine, rather than being the pet of a human. I asked Tessa whether she noticed any kind of clothing, or even a wristwatch on the creature, and she replied that she saw nothing of that nature, not even a dog collar. And she didn't feel frightened, she said, only shocked and curious. She was especially amazed that such a creature would appear in the city and riding in a car, no less, rather than out in the wilds somewhere. The city of Orange, after all, is flanked to its east by Santiago Oaks Regional Park, Irvine Lake, the Cleveland National Forest, and the Santa Ana Mountains. And the sighting felt both personal and intentional to her. "I have always thought that sighting was meant specifically for me," she said, "but I don't know whether to take it as a gift or a threat." She also said that she wished she could have told her husband about it, but he had already passed away. I agree that he probably would have enjoyed the story. Much later, a 1991 New York Times book review of a Dick biography quoted him as musing, "In my writing, I even question the universe. I wonder out loud if it is real, and I wonder out loud if all of us are real." That's a valid question, especially if some of us are wolves with hands. Encounter case summary. The VIP Werewolf of Orange. Reported creature or creatures. An all-black German Shepherd riding in the back seat of a limousine. Location, date, El Modena neighborhood of Orange, California, in mid to late spring, 1982. Conditions, daytime, pleasant warm weather, viewing distance only a few feet. Associated phenomena, non-observed. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. Creature with canid head and upper torso displayed human-like lower arm and hand to eyewitness, seemed to be smiling and enjoying witness's shock. Witness or witnesses, a 28-year-old woman attending Chapman College. Environmental factors. City adjacent or close to large parks, lake, and mountains. LA's Leapin' Lichen. Although wolves in men's or women's clothing are a rarity, at least in the sightings reports I receive, dapper dog men like the Torrance Tunnel Beast do show up now and then. I received another such report that was also from the Los Angeles area in March 2014 from a woman named Mary May, a former actress and producer from Palm Desert, who literally almost ran into a very frightening figure while walking in a Los Angeles park in 1972. May, 24, and her boyfriend John had entered MacArthur Park, yes, the one made famous by singers Richard Harris and Donna Summers, from its northeast entrance at Alvarado and 6th Streets, just as the sun was setting. It had been a warm, clear August day, and the couple looked forward to a romantic twilight stroll. The 35-acre recreational area, originally known as West Lake Park, would become infamous for problems with crime and drugs a decade later, but in the early 1970s, it was still a place where people could expect a peaceful jaunt on the well-tended paths winding around a small lake. And at that hour of the evening, they pretty much had the park to themselves, said May. It was almost deserted, she wrote, although she and John would soon find out that wasn't entirely true. She continued, from the opposite side of the trail, I could see someone running toward us about 20 or 30 feet away. He looked like he was jogging really fast. Something about the figure seemed strange. His gait was real aggressive. I felt afraid and lagged back, not wanting this figure to notice us as it ran by. My instincts told me there was something really wrong with this person. I felt threatened. I felt danger. The figure continued moving toward them, she said, but just before it reached the couple, it suddenly changed course slightly and leaped over a park bench as if it were nothing, said May, adding that it easily cleared the bench by a couple of feet and then continued on its way. He did not turn back to look at us, showing he did not see us. Thank God, she added. May had good reason to include that expression of gratitude. When he sailed over the bench and kept running till he was out of view, he was so close to me I could see his head. I saw what I was afraid of, said May. He had a wolf's head. I don't remember what clothes he had on. I think he had shoes. All I remember was that long wolf's snout. It did not look like a mask. It looked plain real. It had gray fur, pointy ears, and its mouth was closed. It was a perfect wolf's head. The gray fur was lit up by a park lamp. I was so shook up I did not mention it to my boyfriend. In those days, you did not talk about such things. To this day, I don't know if he saw it also. I was so traumatized I didn't want to talk with anyone about it either. The strange runner appeared to be about 6 feet tall and weighed at least 180 pounds, May estimated. After he leaped over the bench, he took another path that led under a highway overpass toward the lake. That path may or may not have led to some sort of underground entrance, but the fact that it disappeared underneath a great concrete bridge provides at least a symbolic connection to the idea of the monster disappearing into a lower level or plane. Needless to say, the couple did not follow the creature, but continued on in silence, trying to pretend it hadn't happened. But May knew that it had. It wasn't my imagination, she insisted in our phone conversation. Of course, anytime someone reports a bipedal creature with an animal's head and a clothed, human-like body, there's a good chance the creature was actually a person wearing a rubber mask. Although it's possible in this case, several things mitigate against that conclusion. One is the unusual speed and jumping prowess the runner displayed by clearing a park bench by several feet, landing perfectly and continuing in another direction without missing a step. And the other is that, at its closest, May saw the creature from less than 20 feet away while there was still plenty of daylight. At that distance, she should have been able to tell if this was a mask, and she seemed sure that it was not. This was 1972, before they had the real good masks and makeup like they used in The Howling, said May. And even if someone had procured a well-crafted fur-covered wolf mask, complete with ears, projecting muzzle, and neck fur, for the purpose of scaring people in MacArthur Park, such a thick, overall head covering would probably restrict the runner's field of vision enough to have made that airy, perfect leap and landing difficult to achieve. As it was, May kept emphasizing the word sailed to describe the effortless way it cleared the bench. The feat almost seemed superhuman, she added. May still seemed genuinely frightened by her experience when we spoke by phone in April 2015. She retold the story exactly as she had first written it to me in her initial email a year earlier. She still sounded amazed at what she had seen, and, like many witnesses, relieved to be able to tell someone about this incident with so many improbable aspects. Not the least of these aspects is the fact that this particular park, hemmed in by the sprawling urban conglomeration that is L.A., is a most unusual place for a sighting of an upright canine. I've received plenty of reports of creatures seen in or near cities or residential neighborhoods, but most of those sites have lain adjacent to some type of riverway, nature preserve, or even a golf course that might serve as a wildlife corridor. MacArthur Park was originally fertile marshland, but now is bounded by buildings and pavement on all sides, a far cry from the lush ecosystem that once supported the indigenous Gabrielino people, hunter-gatherers who lived there when the Spaniards first arrived. The question that occurs to me next, then, concerns where that wolf-headed creature would have come from. I doubt it lived on the street-level park grounds, or there would have been many more sightings, and it also probably wouldn't have been able to romp around the surrounding urban environment without attracting attention. The park itself does feature pedestrian walkway tunnels under Wilshire Boulevard, and this was exactly the place the wolf-headed jogger was making for when Mary May saw it jump the park bench. Is it possible there actually is a larger tunnel system under Los Angeles, whereby lycanthropic or other sorts of creatures may travel from park to park unobserved? I would imagine that a city park with tourist attractions such as a special pool for its resident pet seal would require massive subterranean areas for maintenance. And it seems logical that these would connect with other parts of L.A. Underground for easy access by workers and vendors. Encounter Case Summary. L.A.'s Leapin' Lycan. Reported creature or creatures. A fully clothed figure with a human-like body and a head completely like that of a wolf. Location, date. MacArthur Park, Los Angeles, California. August 1972. Conditions. Warm, clear weather, just at dusk, but still light out, aided by park lights. Associated phenomena. Creature ran out of sight under concrete highway span. Otherwise, none. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. Wolf-like head, seen at close range in good light, appeared authentic to species and very real, yet was set on clothed, humanoid body. Creature jogged, or ran, at great speed, and leaped over a park bench with great ease to continue on another path. Witness or witnesses. a young woman in early 20s, and her boyfriend at the time, not in current association. Environmental factors. Lake and wooded, 38-acre area that may hold ancient sacred tribal traditions in its history, set in urban environment of Los Angeles, in area of known abandoned tunnel systems. Solar flares. This event occurred only a month after one of the largest solar flares measured by man, and one that knocked out communications in various places. There is speculation that the electromagnetic fields of living and perhaps semi-living creatures may also be affected by solar activity. LA's Tunnel Labyrinth. I'll admit that scenarios that I think would be logical don't always turn out to have a basis in fact, but this far-flung system of subterranean tunnels under Los Angeles is indeed a reality. I can list at least three different types of tunnel systems, and these are just the ones well known to the public. For starters, there are the crumbling and abandoned remains of what was once the Pacific Electric Hollywood Subway. Opened in 1925 as a way to bring people to downtown LA from the city's expansive suburbs, the massive project never competed successfully enough against the public's growing love affair with the automobile to become a paying proposition. Its last sad excursion was made June 19, 1955. The stations and cavernous tunnels remained open to curiosity seekers, loiterers, and even film crews for years, but were officially declared condemned and completely sealed in 2014. Another set of tunnels that crisscross much of downtown Los Angeles were used as service passages for booze runners and secret drinking establishments during Prohibition, 1920 to 1933. At the time of this book's writing, some of the city's tunnels that lie under government buildings could still be visited via an unmarked elevator just behind the city's Hall of Records. The Lost Lizard People of L.A. Then there are the allegedly much older, say 5,000 years, give or take an era, tunnels that were allegedly dug as a secret lair by lizard people. Yes, lizard people. This is L.A. we're talking about. A mining engineer named George Warren Shufelt became a national sensation when he went public in 1934 with this news of lizard folk. According to Shufelt, they were an ancient but very intelligent people with technology far superior to the other tribes living circa 3000 BC. And they probably weren't reptilians. Several sources I found made it clear that the lizard people were humans, albeit advanced ones. Ancient Hopi ancestral legends refer to a lizard clan that was part of the larger Sand Clan and known for its wide migrations. Tribal tradition stated that these people prepared for future catastrophes by carving out huge underground shelter cities in different sites around the Pacific coastal region, and that, depending on the source, they had created between 3 and 5 such complexes. They accomplished this Herculean feat by using a powerful chemical substance that somehow replaced the rock boring process. Legends also said that the roomy, concrete-lined caverns were stockpiled with great stores of food and water, enough to support 1,000 inhabitants, as well as hoards of gold and other riches. One of these subterranean splendors lay right under central L.A., according to Shufelt, who said he obtained his information from a member of the Hopi tribe named Chief Greenleaf, or, alternatively, L. Melkin. There are at present no known legal records of this man by either name, but he was said by news reports to be Shufelt's lore advisor and digging partner. Greenleaf had contacted Shufelt after he learned the engineer said he'd found a tunnel system under Los Angeles with the aid of a machine he invented and dubbed the Radio X-Ray. While X-rays had been known to modern science since 1895, with machines developed specifically for medical use by 1913, the idea that X-rays could be used to see deep into the earth was a novelty. Shufeldt's machine looked mostly like a dowsing pendant encased in glass, but Shufeldt insisted it could identify the composition of certain objects, such as a fabulous set of 4-foot-long solid gold tablets covered with inscriptions. He said the tablets were stored in large rooms connected by a maze of tunnels that began in Elysian Park and then wove their entangled way southward to the Los Angeles Public Library. Shufeldt's map of the complex showed that the tunnel system itself formed the rough shape of a lizard. The only thing left to do was dig. After forming an excavation agreement with the city, Shufeldt and Chief Greenleaf began their dig project on a promising spot on North Hill Street, as the public monitored his progress, like an engineering soap opera by folks in the grip of the Depression, according to a 2014 article in Los Angeles Magazine. But after digging 5 shafts as deep as 250 feet into LA's subsurface with no sign of gold, ancient mummies, or even the remains of a tunnel, most people lost interest in the project, and Shufeldt was forced to abandon his search. The city quickly found other uses for the dig areas, and within decades was far too developed for such a large-scale dig project to be mounted again. No one seems to know what became of Shufeldt or Greenleaf. Their detailed map of the supposed underground complex is now appropriately held in the collection of the Central Library, the spot Shufeldt believed to be the southernmost point of the lizard people's chambers. I can't restrain myself from pointing out that the library site lies only about 5,000 feet west of MacArthur Park, a straight shot down 6th Street to the very entrance used by Mary May and her boyfriend that evening in 1972. Whether or not the lizard people tunnels were real, it is a fact that many miles of known modern-day tunnels form a mostly abandoned honeycomb below Los Angeles. Just because most of them may be closed to the public, they aren't necessarily uninhabited. It simply makes them more attractive to furtive trespassers who wish to go about their business in secret. Perhaps, then, there really is some possible association between old underground passages and mysterious beings, such as the MacArthur Park wolf-headed jogger and the Torrance parking lot transformer. 2. Neither Man Nor Beast. Chapter 3. They Walk Among Us. A Dog's Head on a Human Body. Claims of encounters with wolf-headed, human-like figures predate the modern era's invention of the rubber mask. Consider this account, published in 1897 in the New York Times, that bore the oddly matter-of-fact title, Dog's Head on a Human Body. It was subtitled, Strange Member of a Chicago Family Seen by a Policeman. As the story went, a Chicago police officer named George Riordan had visited the home of the Albert Janeco family to serve one of its members with an arrest warrant for disorderly conduct. He hadn't expected the visit to be pleasant, but the family seemed extremely upset by his presence. They did not speak English, but evidently found an interpreter who helped persuade him to peek into the home's back room. Now it was Officer Riordan's turn to be upset. In the room sat a person with a human body but a canine head. The article didn't describe its exact features, but noted that the family feared the officer had come to take the cynocephalic being from them. The dog-headed man was 22 years old and the Janeco's son, they explained. The shaken policeman left without arresting anyone and stuck to his story, even though he endured ribbing from his colleagues back at the station. Given the family's obvious affection for and acceptance of the young man, I expect it's likely that he was no demon-spawn monster. He probably suffered from a certain rare congenital disorder called hypertrichosis, in which people are born covered with thick hair over their entire bodies. They are otherwise perfectly normal human beings, but I suspect many tales and rumors of werewolves have been inspired over the years by glimpses of those few individuals afflicted with this hairy condition. Michigan dog at the door. There are other historic cases in which the hairy one seems definitely malign, however. A Michigan woman wrote me in 2014 about an eerie incident her own great-grandfather experienced in the 1920s in the downriver area of Rockwood, which lies along the Huron River in the southernmost tip of Detroit, only a few miles from Lake Erie and Gros Isle, the site of some well-known werewolf tales that date back to early French immigrants in the 1700s. The man, who happened to be of French heritage from a family prominent in Detroit's early history, was driving on a country road in that vicinity when one of his tires went flat. A much more calamitous event in the days before service stations on every corner. He had no choice but to walk to the nearest farmhouse and hope its owners would be friendly and kind enough to help him. When he knocked on the door, a large dog answered, wrote the woman. It was standing on its hind legs, like a man, and spoke in English, "Go or I'll kill you." My great-grandfather ran to his car and drove that car all the way home on the flat tire. My grandfather, who related the story to her, swore it was a true story, and this experience frightened his father, who never forgot what happened. Encounter Case Summary. Michigan House Lichen. Reported creature or creatures. Upright, wolf-like creature that spoke English and either lived in or had momentary possession of a rural farmhouse. Location, date. Rural Detroit, 1920s. Conditions. Time of day, season, and weather unknown. Associated phenomena. None observed. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. Appeared as a fully physical wolf, yet stood upright, answered knock at door, and spoke English in a human voice. Witness or witnesses. The great-grandfather of a Michigan woman, name withheld, from one of Detroit's founding families. Environmental factors. Low population area. Road probably deserted. Not far from river and Great Lakes. Rural setting with fields, woods, and farm animals. The New York Hoodie Wolf. A policeman named Dave from central New York State wrote in 2012 to say he'd had two run-ins with mysterious canines during his life, and one incident involved a garbed figure. He was 53 at the time of his letter, and that event occurred on a police call he'd made around 2006. "I got a call of someone trespassing on someone's lawn," he wrote. "It was wintertime, and near a wooded area that went up a steep hill. The owner came out of the house and told me a man had walked across his lawn, and pointed toward the edge of the woods. I walked over to this area. There was about 1.5 feet of snow. I get over there, and the only tracks there are of big paw prints, and only of two paws. No front paws. The tracks went back to the woods and left. I went back to the guy and told him it was just dog tracks, and it had left the area. He got kind of mad at me and said it was a man walking through there." Dave, however, was not about to tell the homeowner that the reason he did not want to follow those tracks was because of something he had seen over 3 decades earlier, around 1970. "The first thing I thought of was when I was a kid," he said. "When I was about 9 years old, some friends of mine and I were walking up the road in a wooded area in central New York, and it was getting dark. I saw what I thought was a guy smoking a cigarette, sitting on a log in the woods. He appeared to be wearing a dark, long coat with a hood on it. He turned his head toward us, and he had a wolf face. I will never forget this. We were scared and ran back home. Our parents came back with us with flashlights, But it was gone then. They didn't believe us. A hooded cloak is the logical thing to wear with a werewolf mask, of course, but it seems odd that anyone would be sitting in such a getup out in rural woods at night. The figure didn't seem to be engaging in purposefully scary activity, such as jumping up, giving chase, or howling, that one might expect of a hoaxer. And while Dave didn't explain why he thought the figure was smoking, my first thought was that he may have mistaken a glowing red eye for a lit cigarette butt. And yet, I highly doubt the creature was smoking if it was wearing a rubber mask. Why risk burning the mask when it would be so much easier just to take it off for a smoke break? I did try unsuccessfully to contact Dave for any additional details he might recall. Although Dave didn't provide the exact location of these events, the forests of the central area of the glacier-sculpted state seem an appropriate place to find unusual phenomena. The region, which includes the Mohawk Valley and Lake Ontario lowlands, is one of lowland woods, river valleys, and other environments conducive to wildlife. German, Dutch, and Scottish immigrants were already farming there by the 1700s, bringing their own traditions of old-world shapeshifters to add to those of the indigenous Iroquois. The Adirondacks range just to the northeast contains some of the oldest rocks and mountain formations in the United States, along with stretches of deep wilderness. Bigfoots have also been reported there, according to an area TV reporter. Diane Rutherford wrote in 2013 about a Utica outdoors man named Jack Leach, who goes by the nickname Adirondack Jack. Jack says he's had several encounters with creatures whose weight he estimated at over 700 pounds and whose faces resembled those of gorillas. Rutherford cited other New York sightings stretching as far back as 1818. I've had reports of upright, wolf-like creatures in the state as well, including one featured in Hunting the American Werewolf that described the shocking experience of two brothers, George and John Carper. The pair were driving along a highway in Plattsburgh on a clear day in June 2004 when they saw two large, wolf-like, fur-clad creatures running next to the road on their hind legs. The creatures easily outdistanced the two brothers in their car, as the Carpers estimated them to be sprinting at about 100 miles per hour. Encounter case summary. The New York Hoodie Wolf. Reported creature or creatures. 1970. A seated, humanoid figure dressed in clothing that included a hooded garment, but that had a wolf's face. 2006. Large bipedal paw prints that led into woods. Location, date. Central New York State in winter of 2006. Conditions. Both events were near wooded rural areas, and the 2006 event happened with about 18 inches of snow on the ground. The earlier event occurred at dusk. The officer's viewing of the paw prints in 2006 was during daylight hours. Associated phenomena. In the 1970 event, a glowing red light resembling a lit cigarette was observed. Unexplained actions or appearance of creature. In the 1970 event, the figure was humanoid and clothed, but had the face of a wolf. In the 2006 incident, the large paw prints showed a bipedal animal had walked through the snow. Witness or witnesses. In 1970, Dave and several friends as children. In 2006, the property owner and Dave, acting in his capacity as a police officer. Environmental factors. The geography of central New York area is mostly hilly farmland and woods, with numerous rivers. The checkered shirt. I came across one other incident relevant to this chapter that I'd like to mention because it also fits the description of another phenomenon we'll examine later. Christopher O'Brien mentioned this case briefly in the March-April 2011 issue of Fate magazine. It involved a Family of Four's 1983 encounter on a night drive through the Navajo Reservation in Colorado. The drive along Route 163 had gone smoothly, until suddenly they each noticed an uneasy feeling that the car was being followed. Very shortly after that, a thing sprang at their car from the side of the road. O'Brien quoted a family member. It had on a white and blue checkered shirt and long pants. Its arms were raised over its head, almost touching the top of the cab. It looked like a hairy man or a hairy animal in man's clothing, but it didn't look like an ape or anything like that. Its eyes were yellow and its mouth was open. The checkered shirt is of almost as much interest as is the creature itself. The late investigator and author John Keel noted that plaid or checkered shirts are very often connected with sightings of anomalous creatures. What, then, was this anomalous creature? Yellow eyeshine is normal for canines, but nothing else seemed normal about this being. I don't think its appearance can necessarily be blamed on reservation skinwalkers either, since there isn't much to distinguish it from the other man-dog creatures discussed earlier. I must note that none of these human-canid combination beasts seem to be accompanied by lights or other strange phenomena, except for the glowing red light of the hoodie wolf, which, as noted, could have been a cigarette. There weren't any weird extras in this next truly epic example either, but nothing extra was needed to make this one of the strangest cases ever reported to me. Chapter 4. The Church Lady Monster. Theorizing about these cases would be a more straightforward task if every werewolf transformation report included tunnels, lights, or other anomalies, but unfortunately that's not so. Still, a trans-species transformation in itself, like those we've examined earlier, is still worth examining. Here's one that was sent to me in mid-April 2015. It's an eye-popper. This multi-witness event occurred in 1992, not in some dark tunnel, not in a Los Angeles park, but in what I would have thought the least likely of places, a Baptist church in a small Midwestern town in the middle of a Sunday worship service. Because this is such a sensitive incident, the main witnesses are providing their names, contact information, and a few more specifics to the publisher, but they spoke to me only on condition of complete anonymity. I will add that the related information they gave me has all checked out as factual. A pleasant religious couple in their 60s, I'll call them Ken and Sarah, witnessed this event from a close, almost too close, vantage point, along with more than 200 congregation members. I could not imagine a more credible pair of witnesses. Ken is a Vietnam veteran who worked in the construction industry for many years. Sarah, a homemaker, worked part-time as a maintenance person at their church at the time of the encounter. I interviewed them several times, online, by phone, and in person. The building where this incident occurred no longer exists, and the land has changed owners several times, said Ken and Sarah. They also wished to keep the town's name confidential. I expect not everyone will be able to accept as fact what these very sober and solid citizens claim to have witnessed, but I have not been able to find any hint of deception in their accounts. They agree on the appearance and actions of the phenomenon involved. They never changed a word of their statements, always answered my questions to the best of their abilities, and did not overstep when they weren't sure they could remember any particular thing accurately. With a story like the one you are about to hear, witness credibility is paramount. The following is a combination of written and oral comments from Ken and Sarah. Ken wrote, "What I want to tell you about is a creature that actually came out of a woman in a small little church about 25 years ago in a morning service. The church was occupied with about 225 people, and the sermon was being given by a minister. He was on a stage, approximately 20 feet from the front row of pews where this woman sat. Ken and Sarah thought the woman was middle-aged and said they didn't know her because she had been attending for less than a month. That day, she sat quite close to Ken and Sarah's family. The rows of pews were arranged in a semicircle, which gave all the parishioners a better view of one another. "For some reason, my eyes were drawn to this lady," said Ken. "I didn't know why then, at first, but just the same, I could sense there was something strange about her. She was a big-boned lady, nothing beautiful, and she had this strange, very strange grayness about her. I was sitting in another row of pews with my family just about 10 feet from her." Ken said he sat closest to the woman, with Sarah on his other side and their children next to Sarah. Sarah said that she also found herself paying particular attention to the woman. "It seemed like that Sunday was a weird Sunday," she said. "She walked in and sat near us. For some reason, she kept drawing my eyes to her." "The woman had dark hair and very ordinary features," said Sarah. "She wore a white shirt and black slacks." Although there was nothing especially memorable about the woman's appearance, Sarah noticed that she seemed to be fidgeting a lot. Suddenly, the unthinkable, the inconceivable, happened. Ken continued, "Our minister had just wrapped up his ending and had closed the sermon and had left the podium to go sit with his wife and family. For him to do that, he had to walk past this woman. As he grabbed his Bible and papers, he stepped down off the stage and proceeded toward her, when all of a sudden she stood up, let out a blood-curdling scream, and began to literally contort her head and body. Now, I had never believed in such things, but on that day, right then, I saw the real thing take place, as did my wife and everyone else who was in that morning service. As she contorted, suddenly she just changed into a hideous creature. I mean, she just transformed into this huge, beastly creature, similar to what people might call a wolf, but actually wasn't. This creature that came out of her was quite large. It stood on hind legs and roared a roar that would have made a lion cower. It had fur. It had legs like the Pan creature of Greek and Roman mythology, long teeth and very long claws, and its growling and screaming echoed in every corner of the church from ceiling to floor. It also seemed to emit a foul odor that reminded him of sulfur, he said. Sarah's description matched the account Ken had given me days earlier. "This girl stood up and she gave out the most horrendous scream," said Sarah. "She contorted and then instantly changed. There was no metamorphosis, no transition sequence. She just changed right before our eyes. She kept roaring. It was a sound I'd never heard before, like a roar with a growl. When the pastor walked past her, she put her claws up and looked at him by doing this." Sarah demonstrated by dropping her head forward and then swiveling her face to the side while her head remained dropped forward, hands upraised and fingers curved. "It had to be a supernatural change, not physical," Sarah continued. "Her face was not a dog face. It was more like a baboon or dog-faced monkey face. The eyes were solid black. The teeth had grown 4 inches. Her body was more muscular than anything I've ever seen. It was massively built, with big shoulders and chest that came down to a narrow waist and then muscular thighs. The bottom part of the legs were thin, more like a deer's, and they ended in cloven hooves, about this long." Sarah made a gesture with her hands that indicated a size of 5 to 6 inches. She remembered that the woman had been wearing shoes, she said, but there was no evidence of the shoes or the white blouse or black slacks, just gray fur that covered her head to toe. There was no tail. "The roaring went on for several minutes," said Sarah. Ken said, "As it stood there looking at the church people, we knew that this thing was evil. It appeared mad, appeared very angry, frenzied as if it were in a protective stance. Its arms were extended from about its waist, and it had long, sharp claws. I will never forget its claws,